Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. Later on in the show, I'll be talking with Julia Nero, the CEO at Let 'Em Eat, a Portland-based startup. Let 'Em Eat connects eaters, farmers, and seed breeders through their national collective and mobile app. I'll also be talking with Virginia Chamley, news reporter at Eater.com, about a recent article, What President Donald Trump Will Mean for U.S. Food Policy. In this time of uncertainty, we'll try to shed light on the impact this recent election could have on the way we eat in the United States. And as we do each month, we'll check in with Marisha Auerbach about steps we can take to care for the garden. But first, what would you do if you needed a slow cooker or some other piece of kitchen equipment for a food project but you didn't have one? Would you go out and buy one? If you're able to, now you have another kitchen appliance that you may never use again that you have to find storage space for in the kitchen. To avoid overfilling your kitchen with things you'll only use occasionally, you can tap into the sharing economy. KitchenShare is a network of kitchen tool libraries that promotes the sharing of equipment, skills, traditions, and food. Not only can you borrow a slow cooker from KitchenShare, but you can gain cooking skills through community workshops and skill shares. I'm joined in the studio by Robin Koch, the founder and coordinator of KitchenShare Southeast. Robin, welcome to the Food Show.
Thanks for having me.
So how did KitchenShare get its start?
Well, when I was new to Portland several years ago, I heard from a friend about the Southeast Portland Tool Library and was just really fascinated with the idea. And I loved it from the first time I walked in there. So I started volunteering there pretty frequently. During that time, a friend and I, my good friend and housemate at the time, Kim Hack, and I were talking about how we wish we had a food dehydrator, or maybe it was an ice cream maker, I'm not sure, but we thought, man, there should be a library for kitchen tools as well. So we proceeded to steal all of the ideas from the tool library and started talking to neighbors in our area in Sunnyside and gathered some volunteer support all the right talents came together and folks started donating items immediately from their kitchens and basements, things that they didn't need. So we essentially built something out of nothing, taking a little church closet and a bunch of tools that were being underutilized and offering them to our neighbors.
So what's your personal history with food and cooking?
Me personally, I grew up with an appreciation for a connection to food, food preparation, and especially nutrition, because that's my mother's passion. So I had a little bit of an unusual diet growing up. I've never eaten meat, for example, and my mom was part of a food co-op group where a big truck full of produce would pull up to our friend's house and we'd all split it up every couple of weeks. So a connection with food and food preparation comes naturally to me and has always been a part of my life that I've enjoyed.
So one of the roles that KitchenShare provides for or fills in this community is that it gives people more confidence in the kitchen. So what's the importance of kitchen or food literacy?
Literacy, I think, is important for a lot of reasons. From a health standpoint, you could ask what could be more important to understand than what we physically put in our bodies. But I think the main motivation for people is really enjoyment of food. And we see that really growing. Cultures all around the world have enjoyed feasts together as part of celebrating what's most important to them. So, you know, if you contrast that to the experience of a drive-through meal, you can kind of see that when we lose quality in food, we often lose quality in community. And at KitchenShare, we really believe in that connection and want to bring people together around food to share skills and equipment and food.
So I want to talk a little bit about this kind of idea of community. The idea of kitchen share falls within sort of the sharing economy. Let's talk about the sharing economy. What is it that makes it so popular in Portland?
Well, when we partake in the sharing economy, as opposed to straight consumerism, then we certainly don't need to. Then we can save money. We can lighten our impact on the environment by using less stuff. So that's really important. But I believe that the sharing economy and the DIY ethos has been important to humans all over the world since the beginning of civilization. And I think capitalism is more likely the newer trend of the two. So it comes naturally to people. And in my opinion, and I'm sorry, this sharing economy topic is one that I'm passionate about. And in my opinion, when we, as we become more and more dependent on capitalism and the money exchange economy system, then we become more vulnerable to forces that we can't control ourselves. So these days, most of us are 100% dependent on a money economy for food and shelter and clothing and our basic needs. So we're all running around really stressed out about money all the time because we don't have another way to provide for ourselves. So, you know, and it's stressful to think that someone like Donald Trump has more of an influence over this economy than someone like my grandmother, who is more wise and probably more with the times. So, but there is one thing that my grandmother can do that I don't think Donald Trump will ever know how to do, which is she can grow squash and put it away for the winter. So let's, you know, empower ourselves and learn from our grandmothers and learn from our neighbors. And, you know, what Kitchen Share does is just one teeny tiny little chip away at our money economy. But I think that if combined with a lot of efforts by a lot of people, that we can make our community more resilient.
So Kitchen Share, right, is a part of that sharing economy. Of course, people have lent each other, you know, food and tools for the kitchen. Why do you think it took this long for this sort of organization, the collective coming together of an organization that brings together those tools in one place that people can use?
It takes some volunteer work. It just takes some initiative and a little creativity. And we, as an organization, are limited by the volunteer hours that we have available for it. That's really our one main limitation. So, but I think it's very doable, and it's something I've been able to do in my free time with the support of a few neighbors. So I believe that people can really do it in other places as well if they're inspired.
What do you enjoy the most out of it? What brings you the most joy being a part of Kitchen Share?
I have really enjoyed the opportunity to connect with people in my community. When I sit at the desk at Kitchen Share and check out tools for folks, then I get to hear about their projects and get to learn about food projects that are new to me, get tips, get all kinds of knowledge, and build relationships in the community.
This is a very specific question, but what item do you find people check out the most?
The top item has been dehydrators. But the one that you get the most frenzy around is the cider press during apple season. But the popularity of some items might surprise you. The waffle irons are really popular. You kind of never know till you try.
What's an item that is more uncommon? That's like a pretty niche kitchen item.
Well, we recently got a smoker, not something that everyone around here has used. I'm looking for a volunteer to teach a group of people how to use it.
What do you find most challenging about running a kitchen tool library?
Well, it hasn't been difficult. It hasn't been too challenging, but like I said, our limiting factor is volunteer power. I think the biggest challenge is to make it more available to more people and make it more convenient. It's only open 3 hours a week. So it's so if we had more volunteers, we could make it more convenient and easier for folks to use.
So speaking of folks using the kitchen library, who are the people who are actually coming in and using it?
It's a big variety of people from Southeast Portland. I run the location in Southeast Portland, and there's also one in Northeast as well. And in our community, you know, I would say the people who walk through the door kind of reflect the demographics of our community. There's a lot of variety of age, gender, and a little bit of multicultural variety as well. I know there's one woman from Japan who checks things out frequently, and she actually takes Japanese tourists specifically on food tours of Portland, so to teach them about North American vegetables and that type of thing. So I meet people from around the world as well.
So the idea of the sharing economy, it's growing, it's evolving, and it sounds like that there are people outside of Portland who want to emulate the kitchen share model. Is it something that could work in other places?
I think so, absolutely. I've been contacted by people from cities across the U.S. and Canada who have been interested in starting something similar in their cities, and I believe a couple of them at least have been successful so far. I've found my neighborhood to be especially conducive to this type of project, so I've been lucky, but there's interest elsewhere.
What advice do you give to people who are trying to start a new project like Kitchen Share?
Usually they want to know about the nuts and bolts of it because they may not have a tool library already in their neighborhood to emulate or learn from. So we talk about the nuts and bolts most of the time. I would just encourage people to suggest the idea. It's really something that could work in a lot of places.
What kind of classes or events do you hold at Kitchen Share?
We hold a very wide variety of events. Anything that is food related that a volunteer would like to teach is welcome. So we have access to a great kitchen space at St. David of Wales Church, and we've had cooking classes from professional chefs, such as a ramen noodle class, where it seemed like in no time everyone was holding a complete meal of ramen dish. We've had a woman who had studied cooking in France and Russia teach us to make three kinds of crepes. My friend, a coffee roaster, had a great coffee roasting class. We've had a marshmallow class. It's really been a wide variety of classes.
We're about out of time, but I'm wondering, how can people join Kitchen Share or get involved with the organization?
They can come into our location at on Southeast Harrison and 28th during our open hours and sign up in person. That's really the best way to join. So I would say to go to our website at kitchenshare.org to learn more about how to do that.
Robin, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
That was Robin Koch, the founder and coordinator at Kitchen Share Southeast. In a moment, we'll get some insight into what food policy could look like under a Trump presidency. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel. The election this past week has already had serious consequences and has shown us we live in uncertain times. It is very difficult to know for sure what a Donald Trump presidency means for us, and so people are scrambling to try to prepare. Since this is The Food Show, I wanted to figure out how the presidential election could impact food in the United States. To get an idea, I talked with Virginia Chamley, news reporter at Eater.com, who recently wrote the article, What President Donald Trump Will Mean for U.S. Food Policy. So Donald Trump hasn't given us a whole lot of information about his policy in general, let alone how he's thinking about tackling food policy. Is there anything that we know for sure going into his presidency?
That's sort of the question, I think, on everyone's mind right now. So you're right. He hasn't said a lot on the campaign trail specifically about food, but I think the policies that he has laid out, we can sort of glean from those how he will handle certain food topics, things like minimum wage and immigration. He's been pretty staunch on immigration. I think we all know what he wants to do there. Things like worker benefits for restaurant workers. Obviously, he's been pretty vocal about wanting to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So, yeah, I think there are a few policies that we know for sure. Based on what he said on the campaign trail and how the GOP platform is sort of laid out. Of course, this is politics, so everything could sort of change on a whim. So I guess a lot of it we'll have to wait and see.
Great. So admitting that this is kind of a guessing game, let's kind of jump into some details. Let's start with labor and agriculture. And I hate to repeat his refrain, but he frequently called for building a wall. And I'm wondering how that rhetoric and then that potential policy can affect our food system.
Obviously, for farm workers, building a wall would not be the greatest thing. A lot of people who work on farms are migrants, and a lot of farm workers rely on immigrant labor. And there actually have been some studies completed on what a wall would mean for agriculture. There was one done in 2014, which was obviously long before I think any of us thought Donald Trump would be president. And essentially it found that building a wall would sort of decimate American crops. If we ship all of the workers out, as he has said he wants to do, if we deport a lot of people, there won't be as many people to pick crops. And that means that wages will likely have to rise if farmers are relying on American workers. They'll have to sort of raise their wages to compete with other white collar or other blue collar jobs, things like construction and things like that. And that would mean that the prices would go up at the grocery store. So this is something that, while it's not always easy to see when you just see him saying, you know, build that wall, it's not always easy to see how that's going to sort of go down the food chain. But I think it would actually lead to probably less crops because there wouldn't be as many people to pick them and harvest them. And that would mean that the prices would go up as well.
So let's turn to food assistance. How could a Trump presidency have an impact on food assistance programs such as SNAP?
Yeah, so SNAP is a little bit confusing, although I'm sure your listeners are pretty familiar with it. But the future of assistance programs like SNAP sort of hangs in the balance under a President Trump. And that's because SNAP is funded through the Farm Bill. And the Farm Bill is a really large piece of legislation that's passed roughly every 4 to 5 years. And the marriage between SNAP and the Farm Bill has been a pretty uneasy one, and that's been reported a lot. And this is where Donald Trump and the GOP have sort of split a bit. Donald Trump had a surrogate go to an event in Iowa a couple of weeks ago, and the surrogate said that food stamp benefits would remain part of the Farm Bill. But in the official GOP platform, that actually calls for breaking the SNAP program away from the Farm Bill. And that's pretty consistent with the Republican stance, what the Republican stance has been for a couple of years now. So that's a little more difficult to discern. Donald Trump has clearly taken a step back from what other Republicans have said. But I think that's the kind of thing that we have to sort of look at who he's surrounding himself with. You know, he's named a chief of staff that is obviously very close with everyone in the GOP. He was the head of the party. So my guess would be, and this is a guess, but it's a pretty educated one, I'd say, I would think that Republicans would probably attempt to remove SNAP funding from the Farm Bill. But that's another one that we'll probably have to wait and see.
So you mentioned that we're learning more now that we're getting an idea of his transition team and who he's hiring. And I want to talk a little bit about His hire for the transition team for the EPA, the man to lead the team for the EPA, Myron Ebell. So I feel like Donald Trump has made his views on climate and the environment pretty clear with the hiring of Myron Ebell. So how will his stance on climate change impact our food system?
Well, that's the kind of thing that it's different than immigration in that, you know, we won't necessarily see the effects the next day. But climate change is something that's really affecting farmers, and droughts have obviously affected huge parts of our country, in California and other parts of the country and the world. We've seen tea and coffee be affected by climate change, certainly a lot of produce. Trump's appointment of Myron would certainly be an interesting one. I think both men seem to have similar notions of climate change. Trump has famously called it a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. I think he's tried to sort of walk back that statement before, although it's still on his Twitter. So I would think that he certainly isn't planning on making that a huge part of his presidency. I know that he is also trying to slash EPA regulations, and the Environmental Protection Agency is one of the agencies sort of charged with protecting the environment, of course. So, you know, if he limits their scope, then certainly they can't do as much to combat climate change. And I don't think that that's really something that he cares to do.
Well, let's talk a little bit about regulations. You know, you're talking about how he's going to slash the EPA. And so he's repeatedly called for decreases in regulations. In his first 100 days list, he says he wants two regulations cut for every new regulation created. So what does this mean for food safety in the United States?
So that's really an interesting one. He called the FDA he's called them the food police before, and he unveiled a plan that would effectively slash food safety regulations in the U.S. This was a tax plan, which he unveiled to the Economic Club of New York. Basically, he wants to limit the scope of the FDA, and the FDA is also known as the Food and Drug Administration, and they are tasked with protecting public health and the nation's food supply. He released a fact sheet in conjunction with that tax plan, and he basically suggested that the FDA goes too far. They govern the soil farmers use. They govern farm and food production. He said that they've greatly increased inspections of food facilities, and they've levied taxes to pay for this inspection overkill, as he called it. You know, Republicans as a whole generally tend to be pretty anti-regulation. Of course, FDA regulations are a little bit different. And this is where we sort of see an irony in Trump's presidency. He's often been photographed, and we've reported on it a lot at Eater, eating fast food. I think he had Chris Christie go out for some McDonald's for the whole team once. He's been photographed eating KFC and McDonald's. You know, he has the famous tweet of himself eating a taco bowl. And Anderson Cooper sort of asked him about this a few months ago while he was campaigning, you know, why are you always eating fast food? And he said something like he thinks that it's cleaner because it's governed by, you know, more regulations, basically, because it's owned by a corporate company. So that's interesting that he himself, you know, seems to like the regulations that are in place when it comes to food, and yet he wants to effectively slash them. So for consumers at home, basically, if the FDA regulations are slashed, that would mean that food is a lot less safe. I mean, if there's less money going to the FDA, there are less people to inspect food processing plants and things like that. And certainly that could lead to more problems with food safety.
When we're trying to decipher our next president's policy on food, is there anything to be hopeful about?
That's a good question.
Again, knowing that we are speculating about what he actually will do in his policy with food.
You know, gosh, that's a really tough question. I think that under a Trump presidency, if he does do everything he's sort of said he will do, then we aren't likely to see the best effects on our actual food. We're likely to see food rise. We're likely to see migrant workers lose their jobs, and as a result, you know, that will impact the consumer's pocketbook. On the plus side, he has been a little bit more open about minimum wage, and that might not necessarily be good for food, but certainly it will be good for restaurant workers. This is another issue where he's flip-flopped. So he said that minimum wage absolutely must go up on the federal level, and he's walked that back in other interviews. The GOP platform says that it should be an issue left up to the states. So that could be a good thing or a bad thing, I guess, depending on which state you're in. And then, you know, I think for some restaurant workers who don't want minimum wages to rise, I mean, I guess that could be a good thing for them. It's sort of difficult to see the silver lining, I guess, when you don't totally know what's going to happen.
Well, with all this uncertainty, what do you think people who are in the fight for good, healthy, and safe food could be doing to prepare for a Donald Trump presidency?
Sure. So I think people that want safe, healthy food, people that want to know what's in their food, people who are proponents of GMO labeling requirements, you know, we still have our states and we still have our municipalities. And Trump and a lot of Republicans often leave issues up to the states. Again, this is what he's said about minimum wage. So if you feel strongly about something, I would suggest contacting your local congressperson, maybe joining a coalition of people, speaking to a local union. You know, there are people all over the country, groups all over the country, who are sort of mobilizing to fight what they assume will be Trump's policies, and they're doing that on the local level. And oftentimes with these sorts of food issues, some parts of the country see other parts of the country and they sort of mimic them. You know, Vermont has a GMO labeling law in place. Certainly some parts of the country have already had minimum wage rise. So whether or not we'll see a federal minimum wage rise under Donald Trump remains to be seen. But certainly we might see more states and cities attempt to do it, and maybe we'll see the same thing with organic foods, GMO foods, things like that.
Virginia, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
That was Virginia Chamley, news reporter at Eater.com, talking about her recent article, What President Donald Trump Will Mean for U.S. Food Policy. You can find a link to her article on the Food Show page of the KBOO website. In a moment, we'll have our monthly segment with permaculturist Marisha Auerbach, where we talk about the garden. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. I have to admit that I have not been in my garden in over a week. The work to maintain the garden seems to be ebbing at this point in the season. That said, there are a number of things that you can be doing to get a jump start on the 2017 season. To talk about some of the pressing garden tasks, I'm joined by Marisha Auerbach. Marisha, welcome back to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
So it's getting colder, but we still haven't had the first frost of the season. What does the first frost mean, and what can we do to prepare for it?
So when we get the first frost, that's the first time that the temperatures are going to dip below freezing or 32 degrees in the evening. And when we get the first frost, that usually kills off a lot of the small insects like the aphids and the whitefly that are on our brassicas and other plants in the garden. It also usually signifies that it's time to bring in our squashes, or if you pull up your dahlia bulbs and bring those in, or for me, I grow yacon and I bring it in around the first frost. But this year is pretty strange. We haven't had a first frost yet. That usually happens in mid-October. And I actually had a handful of raspberries this week, which is really strange. As tasty as they were, I felt kind of odd. So as we prepare for the first frost, it's good to watch the evening temperatures and to see when that might happen. If you have things outside that might be damaged by frost, you could throw a blanket on them. You could potentially build a cold frame if you have enough time to plan ahead. And I just hope for a first frost so it can knock back those massive populations of aphids and whiteflies that we're suffering from because of not having much of a frost last year.
So I know I have a lot of aphids on one of my kale plants, and it looks like it's maybe on its way out. Is there something we can do right now while we're waiting for the first frost?
What I usually do for aphids is I'll use either like safer soap. I'll put that on in solution, and I'll wipe it on the leaves, which will kill all those soft-bodied insects. You can get those sticky tabs that you can hang from your plants, and they'll attach to that. In the summertime, it's good to have beneficial insects that'll eat the white flies and the aphids, but we're cold enough that a lot of those beneficial insects aren't going to be so active in the garden right now.
So is it possible to plant or seed anything in the garden?
Fava beans can be seeded throughout the year. Fava beans are a great cover crop for building soil tilth and for fixing nitrogen. You can also eat the leaves of the fava beans as well as the pods. But if you're going to be eating your fava beans for the pods, then you're not going to get as much nitrogen fixing abilities. You know, and it's worth saying that our changing weather is really a wild card in this climate. I think that there's many things that might be germinating right now that we wouldn't have seen before. I wouldn't tell people to not plant lettuce right now. We could put lettuce in and see what happens. Nothing is reliable, really, for planting after right now we're in mid-November. So usually we say cover crops should be planted by mid-October, early November. You can still plant garlic right now or shallots. But, you know, for some of those marginal things that we plant in the as the cool season approaches in the end of the summer, it might work. So it's worth trying if you got the seed.
So what kind of materials like compost, amendment, should we be putting in the garden to prepare for next season?
One thing that I've been thinking about in my garden at this time is to think about mulching pretty well. With some of the rainstorms we've been getting, for me, they're reminiscent of living in the Midwest. They're different quality of rain than we used to get here in the Pacific Northwest. So those raindrops can cause compaction on our soil, and we really want soils to remain fluffy in the garden so that we have really good airflow and water flow come springtime. So mulch can be very important. Compost is good to put on top dressing your crops that are still producing. So if you've got the fall brassicas or lettuces or any greens, garlic, if you're going to be planting garlic, it's good to be putting your compost in the garden.
And how about any amendment?
Yeah, all the amendments that take a while to break down are best to put in right now. That would be stuff like glacial rock dust, lime, and get a soil test first if you're going to be liming your soil. Soil tests are offered through A&L Labs. Concentrates in Milwaukee will help people read a soil test. And often we don't need the magnesium that comes from adding dolomite lime in the soil. So I'd recommend generally in the Pacific Northwest, we want to be adding agricultural lime to sweeten our soil and make it a little bit more neutral to sweeten up that acidic soil we have.
So I know that plants are growing slower at this time of year. Is there anything we should be doing differently when harvesting from plants? And I'm thinking like kale, chard, some of those
things. Yeah, the primary thing I'm looking at is to watch for airflow. We're prone to fungal diseases in the winter because of all the rain and humidity. So I tend to like to thin the leaves. If I have leaves that are getting eaten by slugs, I'll pick those off and compost them or bring them to the rabbits. I like to have a good airflow beneath my plant. So that's mostly what I'm looking for with the kales.
So speaking of slugs, what can I do to keep up with the slugs that are in my garden?
You know, it's amazing. For every slug that we get right now, that prevents 100 slugs by winter and 200 slugs by spring. So one slug right now will turn into 200 in the spring growing season. I like to hand pick my slugs. I go out at night with a flashlight. And that's basically because slugs come from everywhere. And if you leave out something like a beer trap or a copper trap, those work for getting slugs, but the slugs have to find your trap. And since they're moving throughout the garden and hiding under leaves, it's best to go out and find them yourselves. Sometimes I will put out logs or wet cardboard so that the slugs can be attracted to that dampness, and then I can turn those over and find a lot of slugs.
So I'm going to step away from the garden and talk about tools. So I'm using my tools a lot less right now, and they're kind of, you know, beaten up from the season. What should I be doing to take care of my tools?
Winter is a great time to clean your tools, to oil the metal parts of your tools and oil the handles, to sharpen your tools.
Is there anything that we should be doing in the orchard? I don't know if there's some work to be done on fruit trees right now.
You know, watching for disease is always good to do. Making sure that you don't have fruit rotting on the ground is an important thing. But I would say try to avoid pruning your fruit trees right now. I've had a lot of people recently talk to me about pruning now that the leaves have fallen and we can see the structure of our fruit trees. It's important to hold off on pruning until February when we have less rain that's going to be approaching as it warms up. Right now we're approaching cold and wet, and it is so prime for fungal diseases, and that's what we really need to watch out for in our orchards.
So kind of like we want to rest this time of year, give the trees a rest as well.
Yeah, and that's generally for most things in the garden. It's just a good time to tidy up and tuck it in and get cozy, just like we want to do when it gets cold.
So do you have any workshops or classes coming up?
Well, you know, I'm also taking a bit of a break for the winter. I'll start up my monthly Grow Your Own Produce workshop series at People's Food Co-op that meets once a month from February till November. And we talk about what to do now in the garden, much like we do on this show. I also am offering a course in Belize in February of 2017 at the Maya Mountain Research Farm. It's a permaculture design certification course, and it's in the heart of southern Belize, where we have a lot of traditional Mayan growers. And then we offer our online permaculture design course through Oregon State University during fall, winter, and spring semester. So the next time to sign up will be in January of 2017. And all of that can be found on my website at permaculturerising.com.
Great. Marisha, it's always a pleasure having you on the Food Show.
Thanks, Chris.
That was permaculturist Marisha Auerbach. Coming up, I'll be talking with Julia Nero, CEO of Let 'Em Eat, a collective and startup that is connecting eaters and growers. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel. One of the best things we can be doing in these challenging times is growing and building community and connections. The group of folks at Let 'Em Eat are attempting to do just that by bringing together eaters and growers. And they're doing it with the help of technology. To talk more about Let 'Em Eat, I'm joined in the studio by CEO Julia Nero. Julia, welcome to The Food Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I want a little bit of your background first. On your bio, it says that you come from a career in digital marketing and media. So why create a startup involving food?
It's a good question. I definitely never thought I would. And I spent, most of my career, all of it before this, in marketing and media, and specifically digital marketing, which was exciting, again, because it was during the time where, social media was just becoming a powerful tool, especially a powerful tool for businesses. So I really got to see this huge transition, and really see what the power of voices that people had and the impact on companies and brands and how they messaged and reached people really had. So for me, it was very natural to say, wow, we have powerful tools such as social media and, all of technology to really help bring people together and unify things, over a cause. So it was a very, natural intersection, which sometimes can be hard to see, but for me, it made a lot of sense.
So how did the Let 'Em Eat Collective form?
So the Let 'Em Eat Collective formed is kind of interesting. I guess to go back a little bit as far as where I was at. So working in digital media and marketing, and at that time, I actually met the now co-founders of the company. So two chefs, or I guess three chefs at the time, one of them is now our farmer, and Leah from Outstanding in the Field, another one of our co-founders, who, when I met them, again, I was not really familiar with this world of food, but I saw these chefs and people who were, they were leaving their jobs from San Francisco, Colorado, to start a farm. Really, they'd never farmed before, had no experience, but they were just so dedicated to this idea of growing really good food to feed to people. And that kind of opened the door of realizing there's this whole huge world of people who are, I mean, they are so dedicated that despite all of the margins, all of the heartache, it's just the learning curves every day. I mean, chefs driving hours and hours to pick up ingredients from this place because they heard about it, or et cetera. It was just the passion that I saw there was so unbelievable and exciting. So at that time, really just looked around and we were all hanging out on this farm together and just said, I think there's something here as far as there's this huge movement of people right now who are part of something and they're a little disconnected. Is there a way that we can help connect them? And if so, what will that do? Yeah, it was really just a question.
So you got that initial group together. What exactly are you doing now at Let Them Eat?
Good question. We get it a lot. So Let Them Eat, of course, because we do have a big team, and so we're able to do a lot of things. Obviously, we ourselves have a farm where we grow ingredients, and for the events that we do, and Carl Hall, who's our chef, cooks amazing, amazing food for people. And you'll see a lot more of kind of our events are called takeovers that are, we do in collaboration with other members of the collective next year. So that's a big way. We bring together people in person. And then, of course, we've got a lot of exciting things coming out this year. So one of them will be the Let Them Eat app, which is a social network, which I know we'll talk a little bit more about. But that's specifically meant to kind of help seeders, feeders, and eaters in Portland or all across the country better connect with each other. And then we have a few more very exciting projects. I don't want to say too much about them yet, but one is fully, the big goal is to allow people to buy directly from local small producers and have that actually delivered to them. And then another very, very cool project, which I can't say too much about at this time, but it definitely has something to do with the very, very critical issue in the food movement involving sustainably raised or grown meat from small producers.
Well, and I can say, having looked at the website, there's a wealth of information on there. You can tell that you all are active. So why is it so important to connect people to, you know, who eat the food, with the people who grow the food, with the people who are making the seeds?
Well, I think, just to address, I guess, the, what's really great is obviously being in Portland too, where this is very, it's big, it's a trend, right? And I guess in Portland, it's beyond a trend. It's the way things have been done. Some would say even in a bubble, but I disagree in the sense of I think it's happening all over. There's just a demand, a want, finally, and a growing one, if you will, to really have a more transparent system and for all people to have access to their local grower, right? It's really about that idea of knowing your farmer, less so about this is how it has to be done. You know, we're not those people who are saying this is how it has to be done or setting those sorts of guidelines per se. It's kind of just empowering everybody to have a little bit more knowledge and make choices for where they want their food to come from and who made it and the stories behind it, which we hope will create a lot more appreciation.
And there's a lot of energy. I mean, you talk about this bubble that is Portland. So there's a lot of energy around connecting people who work in seeds, farmers, eaters, chefs here in Portland. How do you plan on taking the Let Them Eat concept to other places?
Great question, because that is a big, big goal of ours. We started in Portland. Interestingly enough, none of us, of course, are from Portland. And we really said to ourselves, is Portland the right place? And absolutely, because if we could do it here and if we could really focus on building that community and more importantly, learning from all of the amazing people who are at the forefront of this movement here, then we felt really confident that we could replicate that. And the warm welcome and the support from this community has been absolutely unbelievable. It's carried us this far, which is very exciting. And, you know, over that time, especially a lot of the other co-founders who have traveled the country and the world working in this community, you know, in this movement, if you will, has definitely, we feel very confident that it's not just a bubble here. There is this going on all over the country, and we really just hope to promote that and make that, I guess, easier, enhance that.
So let's talk about one of your tools that you want to use to sort of to promote that. You guys are developing an app. What is this app going to do?
Yes, so this app, as far as, I mean, yeah, that'll be the first thing you see from us this year. And the idea there is just a very standard social network. So we're starting there to address the issue of just access. Recognizing, of course, that a lot of people do right now connect, follow farmers or chefs. It's a big thing. People love food. It's one of the most popular topics and things shared on social media. So it's more of a niche social network that's very dedicated to that, where seeders, feeders, and eaters will be able to sign in and say, you know, I guess pick their role, if you will. And for farmers and local producers, it gives them the opportunity to say, hey, we're wholesale, we do CSA. This is, you promote themselves really to a more targeted audience, also somewhere for, you know, for chefs or buyers to have a little bit more insight into the farms, and really putting, again, kind of a story to these people behind the food in our communities.
So without giving away the trade secrets, what components make up an app that effectively connects people?
Well, I think the app, you know, and that was our original idea, obviously, which was very, very focused on sharing these stories and connecting people, and that question of what will happen. And, you know, that was 2 years ago. And when we started building that, which will be coming out in that time, of course, though, through the research and all the people that we've been talking to and all of the lessons learned and trial and error ourselves, we want to really extend that idea with some tools that address, I think, some of the more hard-pressing issues for this movement, such as access, distribution, and pricing. So some of those things, as far as the app goes, that'll be the first thing you'll see from us. But then, I guess, again, not to give away too much, the second pieces that you'll be seeing later in the year are really meant to be an extension of that, that are dealing a little bit more with the nitty-gritty that we believe will make a greater impact.
And do you have an idea when the app is coming out?
Right now, our target is for January.
Great. And what have you learned personally by being a part of Let 'Em Eat?
Well, I have learned so much. I believe I have the best job in the world, which is every day I get to meet people who love food. And I've learned a lot about, I feel hopeful every day, just knowing that there are so many people out there who love something so much and are so dedicated to providing everybody, I don't know, just a little, or better food. I don't know. It's something that's really crazy to think about, but I am inspired by them every day and just really grateful that I get to work in a world where I can help that at all.
So you're growing this business that is connecting people. What do you want to see happen with it? Where do you want it to go?
Big goal is we'd like to, of course, make sustainably grown local food more accessible to everybody, to really help put legs and improve the efficiencies of local food systems, and ultimately to make it more profitable and easier to be a small farmer or producer.
And what's your plan to get people on board? How are people gonna to get engaged with you at Let 'Em Eat?
Well, we love to feed people. We've got a great team of amazing chefs and farmers who grow their food. So that's probably the most exciting way. And then, of course, following the stories, learning more, and collaborating with us. So when we come to your town or anything like that, we get to work with you and help feed people and share the stories of your community.
So how can people connect with Let 'Em Eat?
Well, you can go to letemeat.com. So that's an LETUMEAT. And then we're, of course, on all of the social media channels. So you can find us there. And we absolutely love emails and chatting with people, so don't be shy. Please reach out. Let us know what you think, and we'd love to hear from you.
So we're about out of time, but I just have one last question. Where did the name Let 'Em Eat come from?
Oh, gosh. Well, it was this thing that I call them the boys, but it's really the other four of the team. They used to just kind of yell it all the time, obviously, in their male bravado, you know, like, Let 'Em Eat, whenever. And we used to yell it then in the kitchen or like after long days, and we'd cheers and kind of like yell it, and it became this kind of like celebration of the day, and we got through it, and that was hard. So I don't know, just felt really appropriate.
Well, Julia, I wish you all the best. I look forward to seeing the app when it is released, and thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was Julia Nero, CEO of Let 'Em Eat. And that's it for this episode of the KBOO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. I want to thank our guests, Robin Koch, Virginia Chamley, Marisha Auerbach, and Julia Nero for being on today's show. I also want to thank our amazing board operator, Tammy. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again the third Wednesday of December for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.